der Design-Podcast der Burg.
Herzlich willkommen, a warm welcome to the new episode of the Hurra Hurra Podcast. This time I have a very special guest. It's Bianca Elzenbaumer. And before I dive deeper in her biography with her, I just give a brief glimpse, overview on what this podcast is about. So this podcast, the Hurra Hurra Podcast, is associated with the Burg Giebichenstein Kunsthochschule Halle, and it tackles, deals, questions, all the things surrounded with design education. And because design education ain't a thing that is very just German language centered, there are also English speaking episodes. So there's the one with Imad and with a lot of other people, Nina Peim, and so this one again with Bianca. And I would just say first, hello Bianca, nice to see you.
Hi Christian, nice to see you, nice to hear you.
Yeah, as you hear, dear listeners, Bianca is not right next to me because she sits in the Alps. Where in the Alps are you? Rovento, is it right?
I'm in Rovereto, which is in the Italian Alps, really close to Lake Garda.
Yeah, I don't want to talk about holidays, but after the corona times, it's pretty necessary, and you live right there where everybody wants to go. And this is also a very crucial thing, so that you are not in an urban-centered environment. You work in rural, decentralized areas, and as I know from my personal practice with my design studio and all the initiatives I'm active in, I know that it's pretty difficult, but you have also really, really high mountains.
Yes, we got high mountains, we got beautiful nature. It's a good place where to be, even if it's not a city, or maybe especially because it's not a city.
Yeah, I think so too, but let's talk about that later. So, but going briefly to your through your biography that you have sent me, and it's quite a packed one, but one question I miss is that before you did your MA degree in Bologna in, I just made a list, because in peace building and conflict mediation, there you had to have a BA degree, isn't it? But where was that?
Exactly. I did my BA at the University of Bolzano, the free university. It's where I grew up in the mountains, and it's a trilingual one where we spoke German, Italian, and English. And it's also a university where on your BA, you study both product design and communication design. So pretty much it gives you a kind of insight of what's possible with design.
And then you shifted from a design, how do you say in the English, it's not the major, but basically from a design degree, you went to... I always forget it. It's like conflict mediation and peace building. That is super interesting. How did you came to that? That you shifted that perspective so much.
Well, basically, I think I pretty soon in the design degree I thought that I had completely chosen the wrong subject to study. You know, although I really liked the tools that we were given to, you know, make. Visual work, especially about things that I was thinking about in my life, which were issues of environmental justice and social justice. But to some extent, I think the project briefs, they never really got me, like my enthusiasm. Except at the end of my BA, I bumped into one professor, Chris Kreuz, who is still there at the university, who opened up this idea that actually I could be using the design tools to talk about stuff that I do in my free time. So about the activism. And so I started to combine these two things together with Fabio Franz, who at the time was my boyfriend. And I mean, he's still my partner now. So, and we started we had lots of conversation in our free time that we had just chosen the wrong university. We were not happy with the products we had to make. And then through Chris Kreuz, he gave us that space to explore what design can do when it's used as a political tool, as a tool to get to others, or for, you know, as a tool for critical analysis as well. But then still, when I had finished the BA, I thought I need to look into some other field. I mean, I didn't want to, I knew I wanted to continue to study, but I knew I didn't want to go straight into another design school. Mm-hmm. And so this course came up, which was financed by the European Union, so which was a plus because I'm not from a family that has a huge economic background that could support me. So I always looked for grants for my studies. And this was funded. And I was like, yes, I think this is interesting for me. It was about international politics, but it was also very much about practice. How do you stay in, I mean, it was still communication design, I would say, like, how do you communicate with others in conflict situation, and how you do you de-escalate conflicts? How do you transform them? And this has been great for me because I was on this course together with lawyers, with people wanting to work in humanitarian aid. It was quite diverse with the social workers and so on. And there, I think that's when I got the point that actually my design skills are useful. Like I could see that within that group, which was very interdisciplinary, I could bring someone that no one else could bring, which was a kind of visual analysis of context. It was packaging content so that it actually could reach other people when we talk about conflicts and so on. And so that was the point when I was then decided, okay, I rather do another MA in design to kind of try to focus and specialize that skill, but with this idea in mind that I wanted to use it for, you know, as an agent of transformation, I would say. And this was a time where I was really interested in how design can be used as a critical tool, a thinking tool, a research tool. And so together with Fabio, we also decided that we needed to improve our English. Mm-hmm. And so we tried to apply to the Royal College of Art in London together with a shared portfolio. And we were kind of lucky to get in. I think if we wouldn't have got in, we would have got, you know, we would have gone to a different university. But we felt on the one hand, we needed to improve our English and we wanted to be in a more international context. Because of course we have grown up in the Alps, we studied in the Alps. I mean, a lot of the things happened here. And I think we were completely socialized into this inferiority complex that if you are from a rural space, you need to go to a big city. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, mm-hmm. your practice is not validated. And so we also had this kind of aim of saying we want to go to London, to a place where it's really international, so we can actually see how our practice stands in comparison or in relation to practitioners from all over the world. And I think that was a useful journey. It was fantastic. The students were the best thing, the other students in the school, about the whole experience. But also there, I think we were, after about 3 months, we were pretty frustrated about the educational program. Because of course, for us going to London was a huge investment, both kind of socially, but also economically. And then we were in this school and we did not like the teaching because the teaching was very market driven. It was very focused on aesthetics with very little, at least to the extent that we wanted, very little focus on content and on research. And so we started campaigning within that school for a different kind of schooling and finally got together with other students to self-organize our learning because we felt like that was the best way to probably go about it. And... So that was kind of part of our journey.
No, you quickly run through that, and I want to just ask a thing. Basically, for your first master's in conflict mediation and peace building, where you went into that interdisciplinary field with so many different skill sets on the table, and you said. Basically, you already answered my question and what kind of skill brought you or made it that you can create impact, you know, like what kind of thing brought you on the table, said like visual translation techniques and stuff. But how did you experience the interaction with the other disciplines? Like, how was that going? Was it easy? Oh, yeah, you're a designer. Did they already knew what to expect from you?
No. Like whenever you say that you're a designer, I think it's a bit of a disaster because you are immediately labeled as a person making chairs or making posters. And it was quite a challenge, I think, to sit with that, because I always felt completely mislabeled. And then I had like a year and a half actually for the MA to kind of, I always felt I needed to prove that actually I could be a critical thinker, that mm-hmm. I could engage with these topics, and that my methods would work. And then I think, I mean, generally, I would say I don't care too much about like looking at the grades that I would get. But in the end, I was the only person on the course who would finish with 110 cum laude. And that for me was quite a surprise, actually, you know, to also see that it was so much appreciated, the kind of work that I had produced, and that everyone in the class and the professors, everyone could see the kind of, I don't know, I would say like the value that this interdisciplinarity brought, and maybe also honoring the fact that I was coming from a quite different field to everyone else into this, and that I could manage to deal with the content and with the methods and so on.
One question further on that, but then you went to London. So wasn't there like a long-term relation coming out of this interdisciplinarity? Because sometimes it's like, okay, we're in the master's class, there are so many other interesting people, we work so long together, so we prove a bit of like social interaction. So let's go on, let's spin something off that.
No, I mean, at the time, Fabio and me were already closely working together. We started to work together last year of our BA. And we had this thing, you know, during our BA, I went on to an Erasmus to Lausanne, to ECAL, which was also, I think, for me, not an experience I liked. It was very competitive, very kind of success and aesthetics driven, which I struggled to handle. But during that experience, I had the luck to get a 1 week workshop with Abake. So during that experience in Lausanne, there was this 1 week workshop with Maki and Kaiser from Abake. And that for me was kind of fantastic, because it was the first time that I saw a design collective teaching. And I came back to Bolzano and was telling Fabio, that's what we need to aim at. We need to work as a collective, and we need to share all our money. That's the kind of that's the key for how to do it. But then when I was on the MA for international peace building and conflict mediation, I think everyone was already on a trajectory of why they did that course and what they wanted to do, you know, what they wanted to do with the diploma. So I don't think that there was a real chance, you know, to open up for collaborations. But also the course, during the course, we had to do an internship, a 3 month internship, for which I went to Palestine. And during that time in Palestine, I met Alessandro Petti and Sandy Hilal from Decolonizing Architecture. And I was very impressed by their collective practice and how they worked, you know, with the context of occupation, and how together with Eyal Weizmann, they were developing this project called Decolonizing Architecture. And that actually led to further collaborations with Alessandro and Sandy. So we met on that kind of first internship, which I wasn't doing with them. I was doing with the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions, which is basically a kind of super left Israeli group of people who really challenge Israeli politics on how houses of Palestinians are being demolished in East Jerusalem. And then actually I came back to Italy after 3 months internship and kept in contact with Alessandro and Sandy. And then half a year later, Fabio and me went to work with them in Beit Sahur. And that was an inspiration for us, because Alessandro and Sandy decided to live where they work, to make work about the place where they're in, and to engage in a really long-term research project. And I think that for us was a kind of one of the best schooling we got, to be there, to work with them, to see how they organize and how they really inhabit, you know, the place that they make work about, and that they critically analyze, but where they also try to make proposals of what decolonization could look like and what the role of architects would be to get into that, you know, to push that idea of the colonization. And that actually, I mean, with Alessandro and Sandy, we're still in contact. We then, years later, we went back to them when they opened their own school in one of the refugee camps and worked with them and so on. So that's a kind of, for us, it's a really inspiring connection.
Just off topic a bit, but how do they work? Like a community based? So I mean, decolonizing architecture is quite a big topic. So like it's a bit abstract. Of course, it's real there, but still, it's working a lot with habits and with perceptions and changing ideas of how things work. How do they do they bring that into the place in which they live? Like, I mean, the neighbors might not have been that academic background to even know what decolonizing means. Like, I mean, it has to be translated.
Although I get a sense that if you live in Palestine, you will know, I mean, what decolonization is meant to be, that this kind of occupation needs to stop and this kind of oppression. So I think it's not a theoretical concept. It's something very real that needs to happen in the everyday. And what they did, at least at the beginning when we were there, I think it was in 2008, was that they argued that at some point this conflict has to stop. At some point the occupation needs to stop. It's not viable. And they said, but then we need to rethink the architecture of the settlements, because the settlements are built up on the hills and they are like watchtowers over the Palestinians who live, you know, in the fertile, I don't know how you call it, like at the bottom of the valley where there is the fertile soil for doing agriculture. And they said, you know, if the occupation would be over, how can we avoid that then we keep on using the architecture as if occupation would still be there? And we got all the rich people up there watching on all the poor people down there. And so they made these, I mean, models where they would visualize how the settlements could be transformed. Because one of the practices that they were kind of observing and studying in Beit Sahur, which is just really next to Bethlehem, was that when, for instance, Israeli military bases are evacuated, Palestinians go inside and, they break everything. Mm-hmm. They break all the buildings in a kind of catharsis moment. But this, of course, like in the military bases, it releases a lot of toxins and so on. So it's not really, it's not helpful for anyone in that sense of like, you destroy the place, but then it's full of toxins. It doesn't quite work out. So they were thinking of what other kind of practices could we develop that help us get over the trauma and reuse those architectures? And that was in 2008. And I think they had a really good way to, on the one hand, to communicate and work with other locals, but then to also translate this into work that they could take to the architecture biennial, or they could take into international contexts to raise the issue. And during this whole time, Sandy, she was also working for the United Nations in the refugee camps, on the urbanism in the camps. And that's, I think, where then they grew grew the program Campus in Camps, which was really about, I think, getting like third generation Palestinian refugees into the skills of spatial planning, so that they don't need to have, architects who are trained abroad come in and think about their spaces, but that they themselves are enabled or learn how they can think the spatial aspects of the camps, but also the political aspects of how do you put decolonization in action, and also how do you, I think it was a lot about how do you live a life in a camp that is kind of bearable, but without undoing the conditions that are needed for, without normalizing colonization, without saying, well, now we're here, there is no way of going back to our land, but to say we still want to, improve life in the camps. And I think this was really interesting because the students went into all sorts of directions, from just walking in the landscape and reclaiming it by walking, from putting on just traveling cinemas in the camps to be like, we also want to have some kind of normality of what it can mean to come together in a square. It was a very interesting group of female students who started English classes in a square. And the whole thing about English classes for women in the square was about creating possibilities for women to meet up and organize, and so that they would have an excuse of why to go. And I think the whole thing interesting was all the ideas and the research was based on their lived experience. And so Sandy and Alessandro, I think they really went into this kind of like, maybe still like what started out as an architectural practice that was a bit maybe more detached or a classical architectural practice to becoming really participatory and engaged and focused on education.
I have to stop you. You're talking like so much, and that I'm not in an impolite way, but it's super interesting to listen to you because I've been in the West Bank for a project too, and I saw that as well, and it was like, how do we deal with that? How do we do that as designers? And I think that I wasn't that clear about that. If you like the idea of you see, as I lose words, like that, the fact that if you work with that, you accept it in a way, you know, like that's what you said, like, how can we change it by not accepting it? So that is a super interesting thing, and I didn't had the theories or the practice role models on that, and I think it's super interesting that you as a collective and all the networks you have show that there is a possibility for impact on that. My question would be, on the other hand, how did you finance that? How did you make a living in that work? I mean, it's you say you don't have that economic background, still working in that nonprofit area. How did you make it?
We always apply for grants. So there, we applied for a small travel grant through some kind of, I don't even remember now, sorry, Italian foundation that supports artists. And we had something, I think we had like 2,000 euros we could spend. And then Alessandro and Sandy, they hosted us in their house. So it was a kind of, you know, there was lots of exchange, non-monetary exchange going on as well. And I think we were at that time, I mean, for us being able to be there and to work with them, just having our expenses covered really wasn't for us, because there was so much learning going on that we didn't get in schools. And, you know, they themselves were working, you know, just stringing it together to be able to stay there and work. And then Sandy, she got the job at the UN, so that was really good to support their work. Every time we planned to do something, we always needed to look for money from outside. We would not have been able to finance any of this on our own.
And I think that is very interesting, because that shifts the common idea of how a designer earns a living from working for clients in a way to accumulate more capital towards very impact-orientated, but also you have to get money to that is very purpose-driven to create a definite or growing outcome. But that is not how you say it? Like that is different. That is a totally different approach. Questioning, because this is a podcast about design education, is to how did you get the experiences on that? Did you, because when you said that Chris Kreuz was saying, okay, there is a chance to gain impact by your work, but there is a skill set needed for that. That means, for example, writing applications. Did you have a course on that in that way? Was it in the curriculum?
No, not at all. And that was why I think we also got really crossed with design education for quite some time, because we always had the feeling that our work was encouraged, you know, from professors. I mean, even those who wouldn't give us like the fantastic briefs when they saw what we produced, you know, they would appreciate it. And this was on the BA level, this was on the MA level. But no one would talk to us about how do you actually go do this when you're not a student. Mm-hmm. Everyone, you know, it's fine. Then you will go out and you will do some conventional work. You will, whatever, do graphic design for, I don't know, conventional clients. And then you would just do some pro bono work on the side, on the weekends, or if it's going really well, then maybe you can, you know, use 20% of your working time to do pro bono work, which already I don't quite like this whole idea of pro bono work. Just, I don't know, doesn't quite suit me. And so we were cross because we were thinking, how is this possible that we are in design education? Our kind of work is encouraged, but no one has a clue of how to do this.
Yeah.
And no discussion about it. And what really I think made us even crosser at some point further down the line, that even, you know, our friends who were just wanting to do traditional design work, they had no idea of how to set up their own studio, how much they need to be paid an hour to make this work. It was all about content and concepts and aesthetics, but no one would teach us, you know, how do you then actually invoice? How much do you need to reach an hour to be viable? So I think that was a very big lack there.
Why do you think it does not happen?
Because they don't know. I mean, I really have a sense that a lot of the schools that we were in, we had tutors who have not been working in the market for the last 10, 20, 15, you know, years. They have been teaching, and, you know, they might be good teachers in their subjects, but they don't need to be out there making a living from actually producing design work. So I think they don't really know what would be, you know, how things are going. And I mean, that's me being like maybe sarcastic as well.
I feel it.
But you know, somehow I was like, yeah, anyway. Because then you go into this situation of thinking that it's you, that you're not good enough, or you just don't know, you're a bit stupid or whatever. And then you actually start to see that this is systemic, that it's not just the designers who want to do critical work that struggle, that everyone basically is struggling. Or, you know, is taking on jobs that are way underpaid, where there is no chance that you will stay in that work for a long time, because the studios just pick, you know, constantly pick new students and get the newest style, and then, you know, bye-bye, whatever. So, yeah, I think that was a big problem we saw back then, and that was about in 2010, where we were just wondering, why is no one talking about this?
And then you started the precarity pilot?
No, that was even further on. Then I decided to do a PhD on this topic. Mm-hmm. And I knew I liked to study and to write and to think, and to combine that with practice. So also there, I knew I didn't have any money to pay for my PhD. So I just went like knocking on people's door, people who I would like to work with. And Jennifer Gabris at Goldsmiths, you know, I explained her what I would want to do, that I would like to look into working conditions of designers and to figure out how we can create support structures that work against precarity. And then 6 months later, she called me and she said, well, now there is a bursary in our department. Shall we just try to apply? So basically in 1 month, we together wrote this application, which means that I wrote and she commented. And then this was a kind of ping pong until I handed in. And then I was lucky enough to get it. And so for 3 years, I actually had time for the first time in my life to dig into theory and just, you know, be reading Marx and so on, which I really enjoyed. I was like, wow, there's so much stuff there of people thinking about the economy and work. And that was really helpful in understanding where these conditions come from and that they are systemic and not bound to our failures.
Yeah, and here, maybe it's a long talk, but maybe you can also break it down in a bit, but what's this, like in your eyes or like from your research, I might have a clue, but what would you say that is so systemic on it? Just to frame it a bit, there are a lot of students listening to this podcast, like students from all different faculties, sometimes from Germany or from German-speaking areas, but also, as I see from the analytics, also from other areas in the world, are listening to, especially to the English language podcast. So they don't know yet. They feel it maybe because they there is some sort of injustice, as you say, that it's maybe it's me. Is it just me or is it the system? But the question would be just to describe what would be that systemic factors that make that situation so challenging.
So what I kind of was digging into was how capitalism works, what the basics are of a capitalist economy, and how its logics work to make profit. And it's, in Marxist terms, profit within a capitalist economy is made on the back of workers. Workers give their time, their expertise, their health, their free time, whatever. For much less money than is people are getting out of their work.
Yeah, that's Marx.
It is this gap, between like I might be paid 10 an hour, but someone with my work is making 100, 1,000, 10,000. And it is that gap that always needs to be kept, because in capitalism, the logic is about accumulating profits, accumulating money. And you never have enough money. You might at one point have enough bread, enough shoes, you cannot have any more. But money doesn't have an end. You can always have more. So it's a kind of endless drive for more. And at some point in history in Europe, after the Second World War, which I mean was such a crazy event as well in itself, workers had power to push that gap down between, to increase their wages, basically. But then since the 80s, we are in a completely neoliberal spiral, and work is being devalued so much. That actually, I think as long as we're in this system, it's very difficult to think that we can have fair wages. I mean, exploitation is the basis of it. And we have just come like from the, I don't know, maybe 2005, 2000s onwards, that also, design schools have had an exponential growth, especially in places like the UK. There is so many design students coming out every year, desperate to get work, that you would work for, you work for a fiver, that's fine. You work for free. If it's a cool brand, you will just do it because it builds up your portfolio. And in this way, we are completely eroding the basis for negotiation. Because if I don't do the work for a fiver, someone else will do it.
Where's the responsibility here in the art universities or in the design faculties?
I think to some extent there is, I think, one responsibility of thinking that you are training workers, creative workers, and that workers need to know about their rights. They need to know how the system works. So to kind of, train people to have an awareness, and then people can still, I think, choose if they want to play the game or not. But also to train people that, if they are successful, and some students will become successful, that then they will be employers.
Yes.
And, have responsibility towards others. They will need to decide, do I pay my interns? How do I deal with them? How many hours will they need to do? How do I treat myself and my coworkers? So I think there needs to be a definitely like a basics, but that's like, for me, that's like step one, step zero almost, that something like this would need to happen, because you need to give people the tool to act responsibly in the labor market.
I'm also a teacher at the art university, and I feel a bit touched in a way that there you are totally right, and that is a very idealistic idea and approach. And I work parallelly. I work in a design studio. We have also like a social economic practice running, by the way, that is more or less more non-profit, and it can be something be less non-profit than non-profit, but like it's something like that. And still, I learned so much while doing it that I just like bring in the courses, just maybe as a maybe it's just the side sentence, something that a remark, hey, we have to do it like this, think about that. And but still in many art schools, that what I heard learned from a talk a few episodes ago, there is still that classic economic lecturing. So you have, but because it's not that it's a great lack on every university. So they also learn and they have their economic courses, but still, what do you learn there? It's that, okay, you have to run your studio. That is how you make your tax invoice. This is how you run with market rights and logo, how do we call that? Property. Yeah, copyrights and intellectual property. Yeah, so all that stuff that is like so old, you know, like, hey, this is how you run with licenses, CC plus and all that open source. That is how it runs, how you can make a living while doing working open source. How do you apply for grants? What is the difference between applying for a European grant, a federal grant, a communal grant, a grant, all that stuff. And that is missing, and I see that. And yeah, I think that could be a good turnout for that this different economics, that opposite economics, that care economics have to be put much more in the center when the focus of the school is very impact driven. When it's just like making shishy designy surfaces, then this might irritate you too much for that. Even if you call that a trajectory. So when somebody is coming and I want to be a perfume packaging designer, I want to go for that. Give me like 6 semesters and I'm out. So. But that is not the focus of us teaching. It's more, okay, oh, that's what you want to do. So let's go to design university and see what happens with you. And then things change. And I think in that field, this new economies, or that, not new economies is wrong, but yeah, this social-centered economies are much more important. That is true.
Yep. I mean, what we found also in the UK is that we got those classes of like, how do you do your invoice? How do you do whatever your taxes and so on? Which was great. To, you know, first year we were excited. Hey, they're teaching us something useful that to actually do in our practice. And then slowly it started to trickle down that they were actually, it didn't quite apply to our practice because we wanted to work collaboratively. We wanted to work with different kind of clients, or you know, we wanted to work with people and community groups and on political topic. And so that's where I think, you know, you would need to go to step two and be like, how do you do economy as a designer in a way that transforms it, that challenges it, that has built solidarity and respect and ethical negotiations into it. And you know, there is people out there who know this stuff, and it is happening. I mean, I think there is a lot of discourse invisible, that there is solidarity economics out there, and they're, you know, alive and kicking and they're growing, but it's invisibilized. And I think that would be one of like the, you know, in the art schools or design schools that tend to be more critical, this would be like something to have.
Yeah.
Because it's very inspiring. And I think it's, I mean, for us in Brave New Alps, the economy has also become our field of design. Like, to create economies is what we now do in our design work as well. To, you know, to say, well, why should we not be able to also design what kind of exchanges and relations we base our livelihoods on, or that our projects are based on? and to put our creativity into that as well, to think what can we do beyond like conventional market exchanges and so on. So I think it's a very creative space where to act and think.
Yeah, and it may be with that shift in design education from creating nice products to creating processes, this might also train designers in, as you what you call the critical schools, to be able to also impact on economic and economic systems. And here, maybe not in a major scale, but in minor scales with real human interactions, so that it's working, for example, in a rural area, in a village that has its own micro conditions in a way for experimenting with that and to check how you can transfer that into bigger scales. Isn't it like that? That is basically the practice that is coming for you. And I had a look because in the emails you've been sending me that it's like a cologne of different work. It's a long list of different. What is with the sound? Second. No, in your emails, there's a long list of links that you send, and it's so many projects. You have the Comunità Frizzante, the La Foresta Academy, the Common Fare, the Precarity Palette. It's like so many projects that we will all put in the show notes to have a look, and it's super impressive. Do they run all at the same time? Are there a lot of them? Oh, like in different phases, but how do you manage all these different interaction-based projects that is so much about human beings and to get people involved and onboarded? I mean, this must be, it isn't wood that is a material that you can use, but it's humans. And that, I think, is very challenging.
I think like all projects are running parallel except Precarity Pilot, which we stopped. Mm-hmm. Because I mean, we still think that Precarity Pilot is a really important stepping stone. But now we have moved into another project that is called the Alpine Laboratory for Community Economies, where we try to open up that space for solidarity economies. And that's, it's just a very different way of reasoning, of undoing ambitions. So it's kind of taking the Precarity Pilot section, I think it was the fourth section, which looked at how could you do it differently, mm-hmm. and to really open it up and try to spin it much more. And so, yes, the projects are running in parallel. By now, I mean, Brave New Alps is quite a lot of people who collaborate. So like in Comunità Frizzante, there is Carlo and Chiara who work on it on a daily basis. And we come in maybe once a week, twice a week, depending on how much work there is. We do a lot of the strategizing together on the economies, on where the project can be taken, so on. But the day-to-day work is really done by Chiara and Carlo. And then we have two civil servants who also collaborate on that project. So that's something actually we're very happy about, that we managed to get into the system of voluntary civil service, where the state is paying for people to learn for 12 months and to explore, and that's, you know, it's paid by the state. They get extra training, they get their pensions are covered, you know, the pension contributions. So it's really nice to get that support for the projects. Then on the Alpine Community Economies Lab, that's the EU funded research project, mm-hmm. Which is really focused on participatory research. That's me working on it, basically. And in La Foresta, Fabio is working on a daily basis on this community academy. And then a lot of the projects overlap, like the La Foresta, the community academy is at the local train station. And it's, we have conceived it over the last 4 years as a space where different associations and projects can meet. So it's really a kind of place where we help each other, where we create solidarity, where we help each other out with work, with our economics, and so on. It really builds on the relations. I came across a quote recently by Adrienne Marie Brown, who is a Black American activist for human, you know, social movements. And she says critical connections over critical mass, mm-hmm. which I really think kind of encapsulates also or speaks about so much that we try to do. And like before you said, you know, is this about scaling up? Maybe it's not so much about scaling up, but about multiplying and about growing that kind of pilot flame that actually, you know, it's much easier to imagine a different economy than to imagine the end of the world. That kind of quote is so, you know, from Iris, from Jameson or Zizek, you never quite know which of the two claims it. But I think it's completely absurd, you know, to state it's easier to imagine the end of the world than the end of capitalism. And as designers, we think that we should take this on. This quote is totally signaling a lack of imagination, of vision of how the world could be different. And what more interesting space could we go into than to imagine how this world can be different, how the social relations can be structured differently, and what we can contribute with our design, you know, with the spaces we create, with the processes we create. Also, I think with the aesthetics, you know, what kind of language, visual language do we use to get to people, to get people involved and so on. So I think there is a lot of potential there. And when we focus on critical connections, it's very empowering because you realize that within what can be a relatively small network of people, you can develop a lot of power to change things. Like in our valley, we feel like, you know, we might be 10 people really closely collaborating, but we're able to move a lot. So we have a sense like, you know, of course not everyone will be on board, but we are on board and we're able to push things and to create those spaces for imagination and I mean space for imagination, but also I would say like examples where others can say, hey, actually this exists. This can work. And, you know, to contribute to that pool of knowledge, I think it's really important.
How do the local communities, like the, don't take me wrong, the regular people, like people that like the majority, like in Germany, there's, I used to call that like the majority Germany, like the regular person that, and they don't exist, the regular person, they're super diverse, but still that, yeah, you know, like the normal guys react on your spaces for imagination, because like transformation is also coming along with the feeling of insecurity, vulnerability or anxiety. So also maybe you're just the crazy academic freaks with a PhD doing things. So how do you get them on board, and how do they react or resonate with your activities?
No, I think people get on board. I mean, of course, not everyone gets on board. The people get curious by the things we do, like with the fizzy drinks we make with Comunità Frizzante. We make fizzy drinks with local flavors where we go through like participatory processes for each stage of the drinks. So we do workshops in the villages where we say, what's the flavors of this place? And then people talk about plants and about the past and stuff they know and they don't know and so on. Then, you know, we go out on walks. We do very mundane activities. But then we try to bring them into conversation of what, you know, if when we talk about the flavors of our valley, we can talk about industrial agriculture. Do we actually like the stink that we get from the apple plantations, from all the pesticides? Or is there something that, you know, we could imagine differently? And then, you know, for the drinks, for instance, we, you know, we do the labels together. We come up with the names together. When there is community parties going on, we go there with a stand and we, you know, we sell the drinks and we bring games. So it's actually all, it's all quite convivial and accessible. And I think what's important with the Comunità Frizzante is also that this has developed in collaboration with Katrin Böhm, who is in London in a suburb in Barking, working with very similar methods of like making the drinks to engage the community. Whereas maybe I think for her, it might be more about engaging the community. We're really interested in using the drinks as drivers for discussions on regional development of how do we want to live in this place. And there also, you know, we're thinking we're actually kind of maybe scaling across, and we're trying to play with this idea, do we as designers and artists always need to start anew, or can we copy what works and then transform it and then create strength together? So we are also, you know, thinking, are we a new kind of international drinks corporation? What's going on here? You know, we are in exchange, but we are not a franchise. We all have our own identity and our methods. And those methods work for people. I mean, one of the work of the projects that was happening through La Foresta, the community academy, was the Forno Vagabondo, the traveling bread oven that was run by Flora Mamana and Matteo Pramio. And this was about baking bread in parks after school. Because then we realized that when we do events on environmental issues, only the environmentalists come along. So we thought, how do we talk about the environment? We go to bake bread in the parks. The kids come along. You know, we bake with local grains and have local farmers coming in, talking to us about their kind of cultivation and how agriculture could be different. Flora is teaching people to make bread so they actually can become actors in that kind of local grain economy. And, you know, their questions are opened up about how do we live with Earth others? How do we live with the other, you know, species and insects and so on that share the valley with us? And for instance, in that project, we also had a puppet player, Paola, who is part of our group, who developed a puppet play for the kids where she talks about food sovereignty through puppets. And this kind of stuff works.
Yeah, and then there, I think that, as you say, that what you create are spaces for imagination. Spaces, objects, situations are things that can be designed, that can be made aesthetically worthy, that can be impact-driven and have a transformative purpose. And I think that is super interesting because as a designer, you are trained, or question maybe, to create prototypes and models for ideas that you have, and through elaborating this practice, like growing up as a designer in being a designer, I think a lot of like cross connections come up. So okay, I want to address that certain topic. I learned to do it in a poster, but now I'm doing a drink. And that might work much more deeper in understanding because it stimulates much more senses. It has an object. It's an artifact of exchange because you talk about things. You have things that have a story that are super super loaded, super heated up. I think that is one thing that I learned from our conversation, that this is like, and also like going back to the design universities. Okay. Training that basic skill of translating issues into aesthetic experiences is maybe too complex to do it with drinks in the first semester, but starting with a plain white sheet can start to make you experience a much more deeper impact 3, 4, 5 years after graduation. So maybe it's a thing that has to develop. You say you had it in like already in university, you felt the imbalance and you wanted to go on. But so many other students need more time maybe for that. And it's good that you work as such a role model is different because nobody wants to be you, but as an inspiring actor in that field. And I think it's very important to talk about it. How do you work? How do you get your stuff, the word out? How do you get people to know you in a more, also in a more broader field than out of your valley or the area you are situated in?
I don't know. At the moment, we're not so concerned with how people get to know about us outside our valley. I mean, it's nice when people know, but it's okay. I mean, with the drinks, it's really interesting that we we get a lot of requests for like interviews for food magazines or design magazines from the US, from like weirdest places, where we always wonder, how do people actually find out that we're in the Alps making these drinks? But it seems to work somehow. I think what really helps us to maybe not to let others know about what we do, but to help us with our thinking, to not be boxed in at the local level, is that we have cultivated our international friendships. You know, people that we met while studying abroad, while working abroad, we kept on cultivating these relations as relations of solidarity, really trying to help each other out as well. And these just are really good spaces where we can talk very openly about what we want to be doing. I think when we talk about our work in the Valley, it's always descriptions about what we're doing. So we describe our activities, but we don't use words that we find in theory, or, you know, words that come from the world of design. We use those terms as shortcuts when we are with people who come from, you know, also from an art and design background. Then we can use them, but not in the Valley. And I think what you mentioned before about that we're working with, that we're designing things that communicate with all the senses, this is really important to us. On the one hand, because already as students, I wrote my master's thesis on the role of the body in communication design, how to keep the body in there, because it has so many more registers than just the visual one. And that really works because you can connect with people not just on an intellectual or visual level, but, you know, you might just have an interesting conversation about taste, and then that spirals out into some more politicized issues. But also the fact that now we make drinks, or that we make bread, or that we run a community academy, makes it much easier for people to approach us, because they see us as drinks makers or as bread makers. The role of the designer is very abstract for people. Like I said, even now in Italy, it's like people making chairs and people making posters. And it shuts down people's imagination of what is possible to do with us. Whereas when they see what we do in practice, people want to collaborate, because they see that when we come up together with others with ideas of what can be done, we have the skills to make it real. And we have kind of, I think I would say, design skills, social skills, by the time, you know, writing skills and so on, to make things happen rather quickly. And that's empowering.
Bianca, that is a great closing statement. Yeah, because we are nearly at an hour, and I say thank you. Thank you for your time. Thank you for giving me and all the listeners that insight into the work you do. I had on plan to talk about the Long Nights document that Zofi wrote. I would just have to talk with her about it, so maybe that's much more easier. And in the meantime, in the show notes, we will put a Long Nights document already in, so that everybody can prepare themselves for one of the next podcasts. And it's really, really impressive on what you do, and I hope it worked out for the listeners. So dear listeners, because Bianca sitting on her wonderful balcony in the Alps, it was sometimes a bit tricky with the internet connection. So if you made it to the end, thanks for your patience, and we say goodbye. Ciao, Bianca.
Ciao, thanks a lot. Come to visit us in the Alps. Bye. Das ziemlich schief. We don't need no. Das ist so. Hurra, hurra. Der Design Podcast der Burg.